Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. Okay, so continuing on with developing practices related to recollection, mindfulness of the mind, recollections around the mind itself. Talked about many of them, the six recollections yesterday and the Brahmaviharas before that, as well as others. Mindfulness of death is another one of them that Ajahn Jeff was bringing up in the Right Mindfulness book. We've actually done a fair amount of that when we were doing mindfulness of the body. But just to bring it up again, to refresh our awareness of that as a very useful practice, not only in terms of developing mindfulness in relationship to the body, but also as a skillful way of developing kind of settling of the mind, conviction in our purpose, and insight into the nature of the body and the mind as well. So I'll read just a few pages from this Right Mindfulness book. The next group of subsidiary themes that help with the training in the third tetrad consists of the various exercises surrounding mindfulness of death. These are obviously aimed at steadying the mind by chastening it and at releasing it from laziness and heedlessness, from attachment to the body, and from the petty concerns of daily life. However, they can also be used to gladden the mind by inspiring a sense of appreciation for every opportunity to practice and for whatever progress you have already made. He quotes the Anguttara Nikaya here, number 6:19. Then another monk addressed the Blessed One, "I too develop mindfulness of death. I think, oh, that I might live for the interval that it takes to breathe out after breathing in, or to breathe in after breathing out, that I might attend to the Blessed One's instructions. I would have accomplished a great deal." And that's just an excerpt from a sutta where most people are familiar with it, where the monks that are reflecting on how long they would want to live for an interval, starting with 7 days and then moving on down through just a few days, a few hours, and then just one in-breath and one out-breath, that they would aspire to have attended to the Buddha's instructions. So bringing it right into the moment. Then another quote, right after, following that in the Anguttara Nikaya 6, number 20. There is the case where a monk, as day departs and night returns, reflects, "Many are the possible causes of my death. A snake might bite me, a scorpion might sting me, a centipede might bite me. That would be how my death would come about. That would be an obstruction for me. Stumbling, I might fall. My food, digested, might trouble me. My bile might be provoked. My phlegm, etc. Piercing wind forces in the body might be provoked. That would be how my death would come about. That would be an obstruction for me." Then the monk would investigate, "Are there any evil, unskillful mental qualities unabandoned by me that would be an obstruction for me if I were to die in the night?" If on reflecting he realizes that there are evil, unskillful mental qualities unabandoned by him that would be an obstruction for him were he to die in the night, then he should put forth intense desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness for the abandoning of those very same unskillful qualities. Just as when a person whose turban or head was on fire would put forth intense desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness and alertness to put out the fire on his turban or head, in the same way the monk should put forth intense desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness and alertness for the abandoning of those very same evil, unskillful qualities. But if on reflecting, he realizes that there are no evil, unskillful mental qualities unabandoned by him that would be an obstruction for him were he to die in the night, then for that rare reason he should dwell in rapture and gladness, training himself day and night in skillful qualities. And then it repeats when night departs and day returns, same formula. By way of encouragement, the Buddha notes that when mindfulness of death is developed in this way, it gains a footing in the deathless, has the deathless as its final end. This thought, too, gladdens the mind. When we reflect on these subsidiary themes, a few points stand out. He's talking about all of the themes that we've talked about in relation to contemplation of the mind. The first is that in every case, their practice is a form of mindfulness. Some of them are explicitly termed mindfulness or its near equivalent, recollection, anusati. Even the practice of immeasurable goodwill, although its name doesn't include the word mindfulness, is termed a form of mindfulness in the Sutta Nipata. This is because the practice of this immeasurable attitude requires constantly keeping it in mind. The same observation applies to the remaining Brahmaviharas as well. The second point is that each subsidiary theme can fulfill more than one training. What's especially striking in this connection is the way in which a theme that might seem dismaying, such as mindfulness of death or the perception of inconstancy, can also be gladdening, depending on how you perceive the relationship of the theme to the particular problem you're facing. This shows the power of perception as a mental fabrication. It can take a potentially negative topic and turn it into a cause for joy. So that's pretty much what he has to say on the topic of contemplation of death in this section here. And I actually that resonates with me because I really find that sometimes just practicing with that contemplation can really turn a distracted mind or a mind that's kind of obsessing about something, it can turn it around very quickly. Not as any kind of morbid reflection at all, but as a very settling, soothing, brings you into the importance of the moment and kind of the sense of how we can really turn something that's not so significant or not so important into something really big. Sometimes, and just sometimes by saying, okay, is this really all that important? If I were going to die within the next few minutes, or even tonight, or even tomorrow, do I really want to spend my last moments thinking about this, or obsessing about this, or, you know, getting myself all wound up? And so if you, you know, just over time develop the practice of the perception of death, then, and can bring it up quickly through practice, then you can quickly sometimes dispel those really nagging obsessions or opinions, views, negativity, things like that can disappear quite quickly. Any questions or thoughts on that before we go on? Okay. So there's all these kinds of recollections, and there's one more recollection that's included in the 10 recollections as described in the commentaries. The other 9 are ones that we've already talked about in one form or another. Those 6 ones that were taught to Mahanama yesterday, plus the contemplation of death, contemplation of the body, contemplation of breathing are 3 others in the 10. And then the last one of the 10 recollections is called Upasamanusati, which is recollection of the peace or bliss of Nibbana. And it's a lovely kind of recollection. Some places I've seen kind of talk about it as more of a very advanced recollection that you do kind of at the moment of non-fashioning, a tamayata, where you're just about to leap into the gates of the deathless. This is the reflection you do at that point. But like all of these reflections, it seems that there's many different levels that you can practice them at, and this is one that just to familiarize oneself with the idea and the perception of the goal of practice, of total liberation, and what the experience of Nibbana might be all about. That's what this book is kind of all about.
Also, upasama as a word is really
peace. Or,
just peace.
Yeah, yeah.
It tends to be extended to the peace of
Nibbana.
But a little bit is still good.
Right. Even just a piece of a few moments of stillness.
Yes.
So I thought I'd read a little bit from the island to just kind of give a sense of the potential of using it as a contemplation, because as Lungpa wrote as the final postscript to his section of this book, the last page is a favorite quote of his from Yogi Berra. And it's, if you don't know where you are going, you will wind up somewhere else. I have to think about that for a minute. So, the first little section I thought I'd read is right in the very first chapter that Ajahn Amaro put together. The chapter is called "What Is It?" meaning referring to Nibbana. And he pulled out a section that was actually from the introduction to the Majjhima Nikaya written by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's fairly brief but very right to the point characterization or description of Nibbana, as much as you can get in a few paragraphs. So these are words to maybe just sort of listen to, and if some particular words or descriptions pop out, to kind of file them away as words that you can then pull up sometime when you're looking to get a bit of inspiration. The state that supervenes when ignorance and craving have been uprooted is called Nibbana, Sanskrit Nirvana. And no conception in the Buddha's teaching has proved so refractory to conceptual pinning down as this one. In a way, such elusiveness is only to be expected, since Nibbana is described precisely as, quote, profound, hard to see, and hard to understand, unattainable by mere reasoning, unquote. And that's from Majjhima 26:19. Yet in this same passage, the Buddha also says that Nibbana is to be experienced by the wise, and in the suttas, he gives enough indications of its nature to convey some idea of its desirability. The Pali Canon offers sufficient evidence to dispense with the opinion of some interpreters that Nibbana is sheer annihilation. Even the more sophisticated view that Nibbana is merely the destruction of defilements and the extinction of existence cannot stand up under scrutiny. Probably the most compelling testimony against that view is the well-known passage from the Udana that declares with reference to Nibbana that, quote, there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, unquote, the existence of which makes possible, quote, escape from the born, become, made, and conditioned. That's Udana 8.3. The Majjhima Nikaya characterizes Nibbana in similar ways. It is the unborn, unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled supreme security from bondage, which the Buddha attained to on the night of his enlightenment. Majjhima 26.18. Its preeminent reality is affirmed by the Buddha when he calls Nibbana the supreme foundation of truth, whose nature is undeceptive and which ranks as the supreme noble truth. Nibbana cannot be perceived by those who live in lust and hate, but it can be seen with the arising of spiritual vision. And by fixing the mind upon it in the depths of meditation, the disciple can attain the destruction of the taints, asava, also variously translated as outflows or corruptions. The Buddha does not devote many words to a philosophical definition of Nibbana. One reason is that Nibbana, being unconditioned, transcendent, and supramundane, does not easily lend itself to definition in terms of concepts that are inescapably tied to the conditioned, manifest, and mundane. Another is that the Buddha's objective is the practical one of leading beings to release from suffering. And thus, his principal approach to the characterization of Nibbana is to inspire the incentive to attain it and to show what must be done to accomplish this. To show Nibbana as desirable, as the aim of striving, he describes it as the highest bliss, as the supreme state of sublime peace, as the ageless, deathless, and sorrowless, as the supreme security from bondage. To show what must be done to attain Nibbana, to indicate that the goal implies a definite task, he describes it as the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion. Above all, Nibbana is the cessation of suffering. And for those who seek an end to suffering, such a designation is enough to beckon them towards the path. And next, I'll read a passage from the same book here, The Island, under Practices and Perspectives. One, it's the beginning of the section that Lungpa wrote. The Gradual Path. We turn now to consider the practices that facilitate the penetration of Nibbana. These practices include views, ways of regarding the world of experience. Our view may be unreliable as a means of seeing truth. A part of the path leading to Nibbana includes the process of reflecting on descriptions of Nibbana so as to gain clear understanding. The need for this sort of reflection derives from the role of perception in aiding, or thwarting, the attainment of liberation. Quote from Anguttara 4, 179. Then the Venerable Ananda went to visit the Venerable Sariputta, and on coming to him, greeted him courteously. As he sat at one side, the Venerable Ananda asked the Venerable Sariputta, "Friend Sariputta, what is the reason, what is the cause, why certain beings in this world are not fully set free in this very life?" "In this matter, friend Ananda, beings do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to decline." "They do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to stability." "They do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to distinction." "They do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to penetration." "This, friend, is the reason, this is the cause, why some beings in this world are not fully set free in this very life." Perception is what conditions all of our thoughts, words, and deeds. As the sutta above shows, we have the opportunity to be fully set free in this very life, but are unable to do this as a result of our not seeing clearly. If we were able to recognize that a particular way of perception would lead to a decline in skillful states or in well-being, then we would happily relinquish it as in our best interests. Or as we cultivate mindfulness and a steadiness of heart, and observe that this particular mode of perception leads the mind to steady states of well-being, we would naturally want to protect and nurture that perception as it increases our happiness. If we could be more attentive to perceptions that penetrate the nature of our bodies and minds and of the world around us, our relationship to everything would be radically different. Our fascination with the world would easily be replaced with a sense of world weariness, disenchantment, or disgust, all words for nipida. In practice, this, quote, disgust, is an inner quality that loosens the hold of our habitual patterns of perception and conception. It is not the emotional upheaval of finding something abhorrent, repugnant, or offensive. Instead, it is closer to the roots of the word itself, losing one's taste for, or not delighting in its flavor, leaving the heart cool, settled, and clear. This sense of disenchantment can be fostered by focusing on the drawbacks of our normal involvement in the world of sensual passions, but it can also be fostered by focusing on the positive aspects of the peace offered by Nibbana. Quote from Anguttara 10:60. Here, Ananda, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree or to an empty hut, a monk reflects thus, this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, cessation, nibbana. This perception is termed the perception of cessation, or the recollection of the peace of nibbana, upasamanusati, which the Buddha praised in glowing terms. Anguttara 1, number 20.102. Monks, if even for the lasting of a finger snap, a monk should practice the recollection of the peace of Nibbana, such a one may be called a monk. He is one whose meditation is not fruitless. He abides doing the master's bidding. He takes advice, and he eats the country's alms food to some purpose. What could I not say of those who make much of a recollection of the peace of Nibbana? I think I'll leave it there for a little bit of reflection, inspiration on the recollection of peace, recollection of Nibbana. And just end up with the list of words that are used that Ajahn Amaro was pulled together in a list here that are words that are used to describe in various ways the concept of Nibbana. The end. The taintless, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the very hard to see, the unweakening, the everlasting, the undisintegrating, the invisible, the undiversified, peace, the deathless, the supreme goal, the blessed, safety, exhaustion of craving, the wonderful, the marvelous, non-distress, the naturally non-distressed, Nibbana, non-affliction, fading of lust, purity, freedom, independence of reliance, the island, the shelter, the harbor, the refuge, the beyond, the everlasting, the unmade, the endless, the cessation of suffering, the freedom from longing, the uncreated, the beyond, deliverance, cessation, the absolute, the law, the deathless, the lasting, release, liberation, total completion, freedom from bondage, stillness, purity, allayment, the unborn, the unoriginated, freedom from lust, the destruction of the passions, the unconditioned element, the standstill of the cycle of existence. leave it for there. Any thoughts, points to bring up?
That one particular place in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha praises the recollection of Nibbana is a whole list of qualities that the Buddha praised in those terms.
Right.
And if one is feeling discouraged, it's a great place to look.
There is one thing. Any further thoughts from the author?
Drifted into the mist of memory.
Okay, guess we're done.
Annamayangamagataya sadhukaram dadamase.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.